From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting today from a wonderful studio owned by Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines, Iowa. On today's show, one man will tell us how he went from a fundamentalist upbringing in Pakistan to an adulthood dedicated to bringing reform to Islam. Later in the program, blogger and activist Ali Etarez will join me to discuss his new memoir, Children of Dust. Plus, a look at the continued clash between religion and politics in the push for marriage equality. Harry Knox from the Human Rights Campaign joins me for a look at the latest front in the debate over gay rights that's heating up in our nation's capital. That interview is to come. But first, President Obama, as you all know, just wrapped up a week-long trip to Asia. It was his first diplomatic trip to that area, and the president spent a majority of his time in China, meeting with the country's dignitaries. Many human rights activists at home and abroad had hoped the president would use the occasion to confront the Chinese government about its dismal record on human rights, particularly in regards to free speech, expression, and religious practice. Listen, here's the president addressing a crowd of young Chinese at a town hall meeting last Monday.
These freedoms of expression and worship, of access to information and political participation, we believe are universal rights. They should be available to all people, including ethnic and religious minorities, whether they are in the United States, China, or any nation.
But did the president say enough about the issue of religious freedom in China? I'm joined right now by Scott Flipsy, a senior policy analyst with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. Scott, welcome to State of Belief.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
First off, give us some background. I know that the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom has had lots of concerns about the state of religious freedom in China. Give us some background on those concerns.
You know, the commission has been looking at China for the 10 years of its existence. In China, it has been a difficult last two years. In fact, probably in terms of some areas of China, particularly among Tibetans and Muslims, it's the worst it's been in 10 years.
And what does that mean? What are the specifics of that?
Well, more government repression, more government interaction in the daily religious life of Muslims and Tibetans and other religious groups. We saw before the Olympics in particular that groups that the government doesn't see as being loyal, Falun Gong, Tibetan Buddhists, Uyghur, an ethnic minority, which are all Muslims, and some unregistered Protestants. There was more arrests in the last 2 years, more pressure, more intimidation, more harassment than ever before. And it's even extended to lawyers who take up the cases of these groups themselves. So the lawyers are now experiencing harassment and arrest and the loss of their legal license.
If you had had a call from the White House before President Obama left for China, and they wanted to know what you would stress as a priority for him to say or to deal with, what would you have said?
Our priorities were a couple fold. We know that this president has said that he wants to not just do symbolic human rights related pronouncements, but he wants to do things that can be actually get done. And so we recommended that he focus on the rule of law in China. He's a constitutional lawyer himself. There are lawyers, most of whom, ironically, are Protestants, house church Protestants, mm-hmm. Who are taking up the cases of the vulnerable and the weak in China and paying a penalty. We suggested that he take up the rule of law as a signature issue, meet with human rights lawyers in China, talk about those that have been imprisoned, like Gao Zhisheng, a very famous lawyer, or Yang Madang, who is another famous human rights lawyer. Ask for lawyers who have been stripped of their legal license to have those licenses returned to them so that they can practice openly. The second thing is we asked him to take up the case of unregistered Protestants and Catholics, people who refuse to join the government-controlled and organized religious organizations, but who want to worship independently and without harassment and arrest, and to find a way for the government of China to legally provide a way for those groups to do this. Now, we've heard it's tantalizing and often anecdotal information that the government of China is thinking about finding a way for unregistered Protestants, what are called house church Protestants, to worship without having to join the government-controlled organization. But we haven't seen evidence of this, and we asked the president to push on this issue.
And I don't want to cut you off. Was there another priority you wanted to mention?
Well, I mean, the issues that are the saddest issues are obviously the most difficult ones, and those are of Tibetan Buddhists and Uyghur Muslims. There's been unrest, social unrest, rioting in these two places, and we wanted the president to tell the Chinese leaders why he believes that repression of religion is a cause of their resentment and not a solution to the problems of social unrest, and to lift religious freedom or restrictions in those two areas.
I've heard some political commentators, as I'm sure you have too, say that the president was muted in what he could say to the Chinese because of our growing dependence on their economy. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, our two economies are at a situation of mutually assured destruction at the moment. I mean, they hold a lot of our debt, and they depend on U.S. consumers to buy their goods. So I'm not sure it's the economic argument that's the one that mutes the president. I think, as he said in China, the big issues are he wants to work on climate change, nuclear non-proliferation, and a sustainable economic recovery. And I think he said he wants China to work with us on all these issues. And I think it's a defensible policy if you believe that human rights gets in the way of those other priorities, because the Chinese will not react positively to your agenda. But I don't think it's a smart one in the long run, because there are millions and millions and millions of Chinese who want freedom. They want to be able to speak freely, to worship freely. They are as much the future of China as the political and business elite. And the U.S. policy needs to be on their side.
Scott, I hate to interrupt, but I want a succinct answer before we go to one other question. From where you sit, how do you gauge the overall impact of President Obama's visit on religious freedom in China?
There isn't much. Okay. There isn't much of an impact. I think it was important. He should be applauded for bringing up the issue twice, publicly and privately. And we'll see what happens moving forward.
Scott Flipsey is a senior policy analyst with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom. Fascinating interview. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us on State of Belief.
Anytime.
Up next, a look at new battlegrounds in the debate over same-gender marriage. Stay tuned. We're coming right back. Hello again, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy, and you're listening to State of Belief. A debate is heating up in our nation's capital as Washington, D.C. now considers joining the list of U.S. states where same-gender marriage is legal. The District City Council has scheduled the first vote on its same-gender marriage bill on December 1st. And as we've seen elsewhere, the legislation is not without controversy. That's an understatement. A group of conservative religious leaders, led by the legal organization the Alliance Defense Fund, filed suit in the district hoping to force a voter referendum on the issue. And the Catholic Church has weighed in with its voice of dissent, saying that the church would no longer be able to offer social services to the poor if the marriage bill is enacted, not too veiled a threat. Joining me now to talk about this is Harry Knox from the Human Rights Campaign. Harry is the director of HRC's Religion and Faith Program, and believe it or not, he's joining me in studio in Des Moines, Iowa. We're both here to speak to a conference. Harry, thank you so much for joining us on State of Belief.
Thank you, Elton.
Tell me what your read is on what's going on in Washington, D.C. The mayor of the city supports the legislation. The council scheduled the vote. Is this going to happen or not?
Oh, it's definitely going to happen. Sometime in December, we're very pleased with that. The council has done a terrific job of making sure that everybody in the city who wanted to be heard on this bill has been heard, and an incredible coalition of faith leaders, in fact, in Washington has been promoting the idea that marriage equality is simply a matter of justice, and the time has come that it be enacted.
Well, I mentioned that the Catholic Church has said that if this legislation passes, the church won't be able to continue providing charitable service. They say there are not adequate religious liberties in the law. Do they have a point, or is this just a way of rallying support and drawing attention to their side?
Well, it really is a threat. It's disingenuous, I think, on their part to say what they have said. The fact of the matter is the religious exemption is very clear and was actually argued for by the clergy folks who are a part of promoting the marriage equality bill in the district. They were very clear that everyone should be free both to perform services that they believe in, even those for, and especially those for LGBT folks, but also the pulpit freedom demands that people who don't think that that's the right thing to do should be free to not do so. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very clear. Their contention really is not about that. It's about whether or not under the D.C. Human Rights Ordinance, which is already in place and is not being debated right now, that Catholic charities and other Catholic organizations that provide secular services would be required to honor the marriages of their employees in the city. And, of course, they would be. Mm-hmm. And so they have to make a decision about whether or not they're going to abide by the law. But that's really the question. It's not whether or not they're going to be forced to do marriages, because they simply won't be.
Who's going to blink first, the Catholic Church or the D.C. Council?
Well, I certainly hope it'll be the church, and it appears to be so. The council has not blinked. The council's response has been to say, in essence, that the Catholic Church has to decide if they're in the business of doing charity for charitable purposes or for political purposes. And if it's the former, then they're eager to continue to work with them within the law. And nobody's forcing the Catholic Church, to do otherwise. So we are all hopeful, of course, that they'll continue to provide services to poor people in the city. But the district council has made it very clear that other vendors are available and will be utilized to provide the same services that the city funds if Catholic Charities pulls out.
Harry, if the legislation does go to a popular vote, if the residents of D.C. actually get to weigh in on the issue or have to weigh in on the issue at the ballot box, what lessons were learned from what happened in Maine that will be applicable to the situation in D.C.?
Well, first of all, Welton, we really hope that this will not go to the ballot, because it is a fundamental belief of the people of the District of Columbia, as reflected in their laws through the Human Rights Ordinance, that the rights of a minority should never be put up for a majority vote. Now, we have seen what happens when that happens in California and in Maine around marriage equality. But having grown up in the rural South, I will say I'm very happy that ultimately referenda was not the way we decided issues of race and gender and other things in our country that we've had to wrestle with over the years. And it's not the right way to do this one either. Should my calculus be wrong and this go to the ballot, I think we have learned some good lessons, and that is that LGBT people have to represent ourselves to our neighbors. In the past, I think we've been shy about that. We've sort of talked about everything except what was really at issue, which is whether gay people ought to be able to get married. Mm-hmm. And our children need to be highlighted and focused upon their needs. When they're in school and have a crisis, they don't need anybody to question whether or not both their moms or both their dads are legally their parents. We have to say that out loud and with integrity, and then count on our friends and neighbors to vote with us. One quick thing about that, I think what we've learned from California, I got good insight from Reverend Deborah Johnson in Santa Cruz, who said, you know, what we didn't do in California was to give the people a vision of what California will be like when we get marriage equality. Hmm. And I said, well, Deborah, what is that? And she said, it's simple, Harry. We want to live, LGBT people want to live, in love and mutual respect with our neighbors. And that includes marriage equality. Mm-hmm. If you think about true mutual respect, you simply don't save something for yourself as a privilege that you don't give to your neighbors. And that's a concept we have to get behind, is giving people the vision of what the world will be like when we achieve marriage equality.
It's interesting, because one of the statements that I've heard more than once here in Iowa is that people who were opposed to this are seeing that there wasn't any great cataclysmic disaster because of this here in Iowa.
And in fact, I think they're seeing from a proactive point of view how their communities are strengthened when LGBT-headed families have all of the legal rights that they deserve. They are more engaged in the community. We are more a part of our communities in significant ways, and all that does is make the community stronger. And every time that happens, we move the marble a little further down the line.
My guest is Harry Knox. He's the director of the Religion and Faith Program at the Human Rights Campaign. He's a personal friend. I'm glad to see him here in Iowa and to be with him in D.C. even when we don't see each other. Harry, thanks so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Delighted. Thank you, Welton.
I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. We've got to pause for a moment, but when we come back, the author of a new memoir joins me to discuss his journey from a fundamentalist childhood to an adulthood spent advocating for reform in the faith he loves. That story's up next. I think you'll be fascinated with it. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty. Since the day he was born, writer Ali Edarez was told he would be a great servant of Islam. It was, as his parents informed him, his birthright. His father, having promised his son's allegiance to the faith in exchange for being granted a male child. At birth, he was given the name Abir-ul-Islam. It meant perfume of Islam. As a baby, his parents rubbed his infant chest against the Holy Kaaba in Mecca. Ali Edarez's lifelong relationship with Islam accompanied him from his childhood in Pakistan, where he attended a madrasa, through his immigration to the United States, where he grew from a teenager embarrassed about being different to a fundamentalist college student who refused to shake hands with female co-eds. After the violent events of the 21st century, Ali evolved yet again in his relationship, or as he puts it, his covenant with Islam, becoming an outspoken voice for reform within his faith. His critical essays have appeared in The Guardian, Dissent magazine, Foreign Policy, and Dawn, the oldest English paper in Pakistan. Now he tells his personal story in a moving new memoir. The memoir is called Children of Dust. Ali Etaraz, welcome to State of Belief.
Walton, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
When you were a child in Pakistan, Islam, it would seem, infused every part of your life. You were repeatedly told that you were a servant of Islam. As a child, how did you hear that and understand it?
Well, in Pakistan, it being a Muslim-majority country and Islam being the dominant religion, it's very much, you know, the religion and the vocabulary of Islam is is infused in everything that people talk about in everyday language. But despite that, you know, I always felt a greater attraction towards Islam as a child. It was definitely reinforced to me by my family, who you know, they were, you know, average folk who really just valued Islam as a way of life, and they understood its meaning in very personal ways, and they wanted me to, you know, do something good for Islam and to find a sort of find something respectable to do in life, and for them that meant, you know, serving Islam, serving the religion, and in a way serving, you know, mankind at large.
You write about attending a madrasa in Pakistan, and you describe the severity of the particular school in which you were enrolled. Children were beaten by the teachers, and yet you tell these stories, it seems to me, without sounding particularly bitter about it, bitter compared to some other memoirs that I've read about religious schools. Were you bitter?
Well, you know, what you're talking about is kind of an American problem that we were dealing with since 9/11, is that everything that Muslims have ever written has either been appropriated by certain political interests, or it has been put out to promote certain political interests. And when I said about writing my story, I was very cognizant of that. I don't want to be a tool for, you know, an instrument in the war of terror, or the war for, you know, between civilizations or anything like that. And the fact is that I didn't feel bitter towards the harsh punishments that we face at the madrasa. It's something that happened in my life. This is my life story. I dealt with it, and I can look back at it in an amused way. Obviously, you know, there are some things you see and you never forget them, and you don't want to diminish them. But yes, I was beaten, and of course the madrasas were hard. But I think that my hope was to look back at it not as someone who has an axe to grind, but someone who has a story to tell. And when you're telling a story, even if it is of your own self, you have to kind of withdraw and let the reader in and see what you saw at that moment, not what you thought about it later.
It's amazing discipline and a great attitude. You moved to the United States at age 11. I'm wondering, how did you find your reception into the United States? Because you not only moved to another country, but within this country, you ultimately landed in a place that's not particularly diverse, in the state of Alabama.
Well, Alabama ended up being our home, but before that, you know, we landed at JFK, we landed in New York, and like so many Pakistanis have come to America, we lived in Brooklyn for a while, and we moved around, and, you know, one of the unfortunate things in the book was that the parts about Brooklyn kind of got cut out, but, you know, maybe I'll be able to introduce them in a later part, but, you know, the story of the Pakistani immigrants, and they come to Queens and Brooklyn and Staten Island and Bronx, it's fascinating in its own right, and you know, when we came, we had sold all of our goods in Pakistan, all of our possessions, and that amounted to $3,000 U.S. only. And we came here, and like the second day, my dad bought a car. It was like $800 for this 1979 Honda Prelude, right? And we were just like, oh my God, that's so much money. How little money do we have left? And so, in pursuit of a livelihood, you know, my dad worked hard, and you know, we went to school, and there was always this understanding between us as a family that we
sort of have this rule that it takes 15 years for immigrants to make it in America. So 15 years from 1991, we wouldn't make it till like 2006, you know. Mm. But we gave ourselves that long, and so, you know, by 2006, I was a lawyer and my brother was working in IT, and my dad finally had his medical practice that he always wanted. So it takes that long, but we struggled in the first 5-10 years pretty severely, and I think because of that, our relationship to Islam grew more when we came to America, because it was the one thing that could really latch onto and really affiliate ourselves with.
You say that during this time you watched your mother become increasingly conservative in her faith, and I'm wondering, was that a result of displacement? Was it a result of what was happening in you? Was her religion something to which she turned as a way to stay connected to her heritage?
It's funny. I always used to think that it was the latter, what you said, connected to heritage and culture. But the thing is, the kind of Islam that she was practicing in the United States was nothing like the Islam that we had known in Pakistan. It was nothing like the sort of our family Islam. It had more of an Arab tinge to it. There was nothing Pakistani about it, you know, and there was certainly nothing cultural about it. It was very Puritan. So I think that what happened is that once she came to America, she got access to texts and to the source material herself, and she basically went and started from scratch. And the unfortunate thing in some ways is that when Muslims in the West do that, when they start from scratch, they start adopting certain, you know, fundamentalist tendencies and very closed-minded views towards things, and you know, they start thinking themselves to be better than other people of other religions. And so, you know, she went through that struggle herself, and in many ways it got imputed to me because I took Islam seriously and I took my mother seriously. So I kind of ended up borrowing that from her and adopting it as my own.
Well, now, is this when you went to college in New York City and became a fundamentalist yourself? I mean, how did that transformation take place?
I think for me, the transformation to sort of stick to the way that my mom was practicing Islam and the woman shunning and music banning kind of approach to Islam that she had taken, I had resented and chafed under it when I was living at home. But when I went to college, I felt so displaced in New York, coming from a place like Alabama, and felt so like all by myself, such a stranger to the city. And for me, that was a community that welcomed itself to me. You know, there was a lot of other kids who had come to New York from small towns around the country and for college, but they suddenly found themselves, they couldn't really negotiate or navigate with all the complexity of city life. You know, there were, you know, gay parades the day we arrived, and there's co-ed dorms, and there's, you know, hard to acquire, like, Islamic food, and there was a lot of confusion, and I think as a result of that confusion, we became very kind of narrowly focused on Islam, and I definitely went into a kind of a fundamentalist phase. I was like, you know, why do I listen to music? Like, why don't women cover their hair? Why shouldn't I grow my beard out? And it was a devout fundamentalism. I mean, I never really became very politicized, but you know, there were people who were sort of, you would see every now and then, who had very harsh political opinions, but for the most part, it was a devout sort of fundamentalism.
My guest is Ali Edarez. We're talking about his new memoir, Children of Dust. There's a lot more to come, so don't go away. When we come back, I'm going to ask him about what happened after his visiting Pakistan more recently. This is State of Belief, Air America Radio. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, and I'm speaking today with Ali Edarez. We're talking about his new memoir, Children of Dust, a memoir of Pakistan. It's a wonderful read. Ali, thanks for sticking around so we can keep talking.
No problem.
As a college student, you traveled back to Pakistan, to the town where you were born. You had hoped in Pakistan that you would find a more pure form of Islam, and you also hoped to find a pious wife. What you found instead was a lot of anti-American sentiment. Were you surprised by this polarization of the faith, or was this something you had seen before in Pakistan?
Well, it wasn't something that I had seen before. When I lived in Pakistan in the 80s and early 90s, America was a very sought-after place. It was very highly regarded, and people thought very positively about not just going to America, but America as an idea. And I remember, you know, sort of just changing a little bit after the first Gulf War. Now, you can imagine how far Pakistan is from Iraq. You know, we're separated from Iran and the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. But when the first Gulf War took place, there was this kind of palpitation through my school that everyone thought that the American F-16s were going to come bomb us. Mm. And that was the first time in my life, I was about 10 or 11, that I had encountered this idea that America could do something other than just be, you know, like a great place. Mm-hmm. And even at that point, because I had connections with the United States, I had some family here at the time, I used to defend America and say, well, hey, I don't know if we should be all about Saddam Hussein. And this is, you know, little kids talking, so it's not really political conversation. But that was the first time that I've seen a little bit of anti-Americanism, if you will. And then, obviously, I left. And so when I went back in 1999, it was definitely much more profound. And as I describe in the book, I had these encounters with these guys who were very, very upset with the Clinton's ballistic missile bombings in Afghanistan. And apparently, according to them, some of which bombings had, like, fallen into Pakistani territory. And by this point, the narrative about anti-Americanism was more about is it a war against Islam? Is it not just Iraq, but Iran and all these other Muslim and Pakistan and all these other Muslim countries that America is after? And I had gone back to Pakistan in a very kind of I had very romanticized notions about it in my late teens, early 20s, going back to Pakistan. I wanted to connect to like good, pure Muslims. And when I went back there, they immediately excised me and sort of excommunicated me from participation in their discussions because I was an American and, according to them, you know, potentially a CIA agent. Hmm. And so I was very lost at that point.
After September the 11th, like a lot of people, you had a radical transformation and you decided that you had to speak out about reform within Islam, that you had to address the need to counter the religious extremists. Was this actually the result of that one tragic event, or had these tendencies been forming within you for quite a while?
Well, I think that for a long time, for my whole life, actually, because, you know, it wasn't after I had these encounters in Pakistan that I suddenly felt I should say something about extremism. I didn't even feel like I should say something about that after 9/11. I kind of just put my head down and went to school and kept busy with my friends and family. And it didn't even manifest itself after a series of those bombings in Europe. It was this. It was this notion that these people who were claiming to act in the name of Islam were really just, you know, criminals and thugs and murderers. And I, who had been so enamored with religion, with my religion for my whole life, was doing nothing to say in response. And it was, you know, this kind of call to conscience, if you will, that I felt that I needed to, like, defend Islam against sort of the people from within it who were undermining it and hollowing it out. And so that's how I got involved in religious liberalism or reform. I didn't come to it from a antagonistic point of view at all. You know, I wasn't trying to challenge Muslims. I was trying to sort of bring them back to their own awareness of what the kind of Islam they knew was, which was peaceful and loving and embracing. And that's how the whole reform movement began for me.
Was that when you changed your name to Ali Edaraz?
Well, that's when I started referring to myself to that. You know, I had the series of name changes in my life. The first one especially was the most severe one for me, because it was when I went to the court, I legally changed my name. I wanted to make it more American. And I just felt that by this point, when I was thinking of my life, that person didn't really encapsulate who I was. And this other idea, this other notion of myself, this person that who is involved in religious activism, who is involved in sort of the arc of Islam, you know, around the world, and is informed about the conflict between extremists and reformers. That's who I was. And so I became very drawn to it. And so when I started writing this book, which was sort of self-reflection and a meditation on myself, I was still ascribing to that name, that persona. Obviously, through the writing of the book, I came to reconcile that self with all my other kind of developmental stages, and in some ways it allowed me to really confront myself and acquire kind of a mastery of and a self-knowledge, if you will.
Tell us, how do you see current efforts for reform in Islam? Are you encouraged, discouraged?
You know, to be honest, like, that question is so, in a way, it's too broad, because I feel like the notion that Islam has to change and evolve is something that has been happening for a really, really long time, and it's going to continue at its own pace, whether it's quickly, slowly, whatever, on its own regard, no matter what. I think that when you get into activism, especially religious activism with Islam, you tend to focus on the text, and you tend to focus on the history, but what you forget along the way are the people. And the people are living, and the people are experiencing life and religion in immense amount of lively and evolving ways, right? And that's why I felt like telling my story was so important, because lived Islam is really the Islam that we should be paying attention to, right? So the question of reforming Islam, I think, is a more academic question, but unfortunately it has taken on its own kind of its own importance after 9/11, but the real question that we should be looking at is, how are Muslims living? What are their lives like? And in my case, you know, my life, despite my immense love for Islam, was full of hypocrisy and sin and mistakes and errors and things that I regret and things that are laughable, you know? So I think that's the question we should be looking at, rather than the one about reform.
Ali Edera's new memoir is called Children of Dust. He also writes for The Guardian, Alternet, Foreign Policy, Dissent, and Dawn, Pakistan's oldest English news daily. Ali, you've honored us, and we thank you for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, friends, that's our show for this week. A very special thanks to the great people at Iowa Public Radio for use of their studio and for their production support. I'll be back behind the microphone next weekend, but you can visit us anytime before then at stateofbelief.com. Go there, please. You can listen to archive shows. You can read our blog, of course. You can tell us what you think. We love that. Just click on the Contact Us page and share your thoughts. State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. If you want to become involved in the cause of religious liberty, or more involved, then become a member of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Next week on State of Belief, we'll have all new conversations about religion, politics, and culture. We'll probably have some surprises again. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.